So we are very pleased today to welcome a particularly distinguished panel, and I'm particularly pleased to welcome Gene Tolaizan, who many of you think may be Senate staff, but I'd like to inform you that, in fact, she's with the Department of Commerce in a very valuable role, and we're particularly pleased that she was able to be with us today. Gene?
Thank you very much, Chuck. And Chuck has, on several panes, told me that it's my job to keep this moving along, so that's a warning to you three. And I want to just keep it short, but sort of frame what's, I think, become the theme already, and luckily we've landed on the panel where it's supposed to be the theme, which is what's the government role in stimulating these clusters? I think that's really the question that Susan Crawford was asking this morning, and the question that we just heard from Andrew in the last presentation. We've got three very interesting panelists who are going to come at it from three different ways. Jonathan Sallet is going to look at it, I think, you know, more broadly, and look at the Obama administration's innovation plan and sort of set the stage, I think, for the pieces that can be pulled together. Dr. Haldar has the fascinating story of the New York Nanotechnology Initiative, which I think is really going to show us how these things actually work on the ground. And then Mark Stanley, who, as I just told somebody, remembers when I was skinny. So so I always like to have Mark Stanley because he's not only been fighting from the ground at what is now the Technology Innovation Program for thinking about innovation in the government when thinking about innovation wasn't cool, but also has given a lot to these things sort of in a broader perspective. How can this program be a piece of the whole rather than how can this program be the whole? So I think we'll appreciate that. And so in the interest of time and without any further ado, Jonathan Sallet.
Thank you. So my professional training is in the law. That means I'm used to talking at great length on topics about which I know very little. I'm about to do that because building on the scholarship that we've heard from Marianne, Andrew, and others, and think of what I'm about to say as sort of a first draft of as a paper that I'm doing with Ed Paisley, Justin Masterman, and helped by Maria Lee, who's here, that will be issued by the Center for American Progress in a couple of weeks. What we're going to try to do is answer, basically, we didn't know that these were going to be asked, but answer the questions that Susan asked and that others have asked. The basic thesis, you don't need to hear from me, you've heard from Marianne and Andrew in considerable detail in their excellent presentations. It is notable just to emphasize that clusters are a part of a lot of nations' national competitiveness theory, except in the United States. Obviously, the challenges of competitiveness and innovation are paramount. What I want to do is take a minute and talk about the fact that President Obama, the fiscal 2010 budget, has for the first time sought explicit funding for the support of regional innovation clusters and associated business incubators at a total level of funding of $100 million. I think there's also likely to be some funds that come out of EDA for business incubators in distressed areas, and I want to talk just briefly later on about why that's an important ingredient. But before I talk about the specifics, let's just make one point. This initiative is coming at a time when states are in difficult budgetary shape, right? That's an obvious point, but, you know, 47 states face budget shortfalls. In other words, state resources for anything, right? For Medicaid funding, for health care, for children, for paying state employees for anything is under dramatic pressure. And that always puts into jeopardy funds for competitiveness at the state level. Indeed, to take the prime example at the moment, this is a chart from California showing its budget deficit, which is estimated variously at 25 to 40, this one I think says $33 billion, okay? Well, think about the University of California system. Think about some of the premier universities at Berkeley, UCLA, and San Diego. Think about the prospects of furloughing faculty and cutting back in various ways. And it's easy to see a tangible example of how the kind of funding that has helped clusters on the state level will be under big pressure. Another example, the Massachusetts Life Sciences Initiative is from the press reports I've seen, facing a cut in some of its funding by as much as 60%, right, because of that budget pressure. I say this because I think one needs to look at the relatively small amount of proposed federal funding, $100 million, in the context of the difficulty states will have, not just doing new things, but doing what they have been doing. What's missing from the discussion of clusters thus far? There's been relatively little emphasis. Andrew and Karen in their Brookings paper talked about it. Michael Porter put out a paper at the end of last year. But there's been relatively little emphasis on exactly how the federal government can effectively implement a clusters policy and why this would be sound public policy at the federal level. And I want to try to address those two points. We know the government has worked at the regional level. Andrew gave you a comprehensive list. This is simply a couple of points. Right? It works best at the regional level if people encourage strengths that are on the ground, not reinventing wholly new ones that lack any solid grounding in the economy, that, of course, stimulate the positive externalities that are some people's actual economic definition of what a cluster is, right? Positive externalities that turn to shared advantages. Andrew talked about how the government can act as an effective convener, sort of making a network of communications come into being. And of course, it's always important to remember that, although I believe this should be business-led, we can't talk about this without talking about the public institutions, the universities, research centers, community colleges. Indeed, I think in the discussion of Albany Nanotechnology, all three of these kinds of institutions have played a very critical role in the advance of semiconductor understanding and manufacturing. So, with that at the state level, what can happen at the federal level with the proposal of this $100 million of funding in the Economic Development Administration, which is one of the units of the Department of Commerce? Well, first of all, I think we should start with the belief that this is a good place for the Regional Innovation Cluster Initiative to be. For one thing, it's an opportunity actually to refocus EDA on economic renewal in a comprehensive fashion. There's been a fair amount of skepticism about the way EDA has operated. There's no doubt that it has spent money in ways that members of Congress see as very beneficial to economies. But other people have characterized it as ad hoc, as unconnected sometimes to what is actually happening on the ground, as not fully integrated into any strategy, state or federal. Putting the cluster initiatives at the heart of EDA seems to me to be an advantage both for the initiative and EDA. And, of course, we don't have to create a new institution. EDA exists. It's got people. It has functions that can be used. Because it's in the Commerce Department, which itself includes not just Mark Stanley's program, but manufacturing outreach, export assistance from the International Trade Administration, infrastructure funding from NTIA and NOAA, it's already well-positioned to connect up a series of different expertise. Now, the suggestion is that the Regional Innovation Clusters program should contain three key features. One, competitive grants. Two, a program of information exchange and the flow of information. And three, the more coordinated delivery of expert assistance. When Susan talks about one-stop shops, this would be the kind of effort that we're discussing. And I want to take the time available to sort of go through a little more slowly than I've probably done thus far how these three might work. Not because I think these are all the answers, but in hopes of stimulating a discussion. A grant program. This is a relatively small amount of money we're talking about. So it seems to us that it's very important that the grants be put out on a competitive basis. And that's really twofold for two reasons. One, to maximize the likely efficacy of the money. But secondly, because a fundamental starting point for this analysis is, and this may come as a terrible shock to some people in the room, federal officials do not necessarily know all the answers to everything. And the advantage of a competitive approach is that it calls upon the regions themselves to take the first step to defining the strategy, which it seems to me is fundamental. Indeed, I think it's very important to say that these applications are to be self-defined, not only in terms of the nature of the economic expertise, but in terms of the regions themselves. As I think it was Marianne said, the geography of a cluster is not always coterminous with the geography of a political jurisdiction, and the grants program needs to reflect that. Secondly, there should be matching. Now, there's been a series of proposals that there be a one-to-one match between federal and state. That's probably a good idea. But I do think, given the economic strains of which I talked earlier, that at least for a period of, say, 3 years, the states ought to, or the regions ought to put up, say, a 25%. There ought to be a 3-to-1 match. Because I do think this is a time that's unusual, and that we do want to make sure that competitiveness advantages are gained. And then after 3 years, we could do a transition, for example, right to 1-to-1, or, depending on economic conditions, more of a glide path. The grants could be used for activities that include, well, the business incubators, which are expressly mentioned. I think training programs at local colleges and universities, given the terrible pressure that university systems are under now. And, of course, technology transfers for small and medium-sized firms. But in particular, what we would be looking for, of course, is for federal monies to be spent in a way that monies would otherwise not be spent. That federal money should not be a substitute for other resources. They should be a supplement to it and a spur to activity that would otherwise not occur. The criteria for grants, I think we want grants that move fast and that can show impact, both economic and social, that are private sector led, where there's a proven track record. Very important, that integrate distressed areas into larger regional economies. I think the learnings are that instead of thinking of distressed areas as a separate part of an economy, we really want to foster integration that brings strengths together. And then to the question that Susan asked, I think a criteria for selection should be setting up a set of goals of national challenges in areas such as energy, healthcare, manufacturing, life sciences, so that we see not only the regional but the national advantage that would come from the grants. Not every place in the country has a cluster. And so I suggest that there also be smaller planning grants for facilitation by those entities, could be universities, could be research centers, could be regional governments, that would like to try to step up a possibility of cluster thought. I think that's useful because it actually, I think, would help regional authorities make sure they make the right decisions about what is their comparative strength. The second big piece we suggest is data exchange and flow. This is a point that a lot of people have made. In fact, in the fiscal 2010 submission made by the Department of Commerce that describes this program, this point is made expressly. But let's just say the obvious point. If we can all be on our BlackBerries during the conference, not that anybody would do it while I'm speaking, but surely we can find ways of having information technology deliver information very easily and efficiently between the federal government and regional clusters. The federal government can provide a lot of data on what is a cluster, what are the strengths of a cluster, what's its performance and composition. And so the proposal by EDA is that there be a national information center. That's very important. Also working, by the way, with data.gov and the president's other initiatives for open and transparent government. Within the regional cluster, imagine exchanging data that just lets people know what businesses are actually located there, or what businesses have filed which patent applications, which might give you an idea of what the prospective expertise is. But also, I think, very importantly, between regional cultures, clusters teaching other clusters is a fundamental aspect of what we ought to try to achieve here. And that could be done very efficiently, not just through data exchange, but through the next point, which is learning. This should be an exercise in learning. Knowledge is not just the output of a cluster, but it is part of what governments need to do as they facilitate clusters. at the federal level and among regions, and therefore websites, wikis, social networking that would help people exchange lessons and understanding seems to us a very efficient way to proceed. The third is the notion of one-stop shops. I want to make a distinction here. There's information that can flow, but there are some sorts of forms of assistance that require in-person consultation, right? I can't give you a very precise definition, but you know the difference between trying to read a website and having your 17-year-old explain to you how to actually get on the internet, right? It's a paradigm. Data transmission should be used to the maximum extent possible, but where in-person professional assistance is necessary, a one-stop shop would be very useful. How might it work? Well, we have to define the intended audience. I don't think the intended audience is only businesses. I think it's those entities that contribute to business success, including public institutions. So 220 programs, that's too much. But one could imagine taking existing Department of Commerce programs, which, as I say, reach to infrastructure and trade and technology. SBA's programs under Karen Mills' leadership, the WIRED program from the Department of Labor. And I would look around the administration to see if there's other places where there are specific regional focuses, but not try to do everything at once, to align those efforts to the expertise of the region. It's a very important point. The point of the one-stop shop is to not to take existing ways that the federal government thinks and simply put it all in one office. It's to make sure that the way the federal government thinks in a region is suited to the region. It's not just a delivery mechanism, it's a dialogue mechanism. And so I would suggest that pilot programs should begin in two different kinds of areas, places where there already are a lot of forms of federal assistance, where we find efficiency gains, and frankly, places where there aren't very many, where maybe there's only an SBA office and nothing else. So we also find whether it's possible to have long-distance professional assistance added to those locations in ways that would be useful. In the 1 second I have, potential criteria, you know, this all has to be bottom-up. I've talked about in-person expertise. Obviously, there has to be a cluster plan. We need tight coherence between the programs. I've talked about integrating distressed areas. And look, it's location, location, location. Right, we ought to think about where they are. Sound public policy. Let me just say this for 30 seconds. We ought to be talking about why not. This is not only smart economics, but why it's smart public policy in D.C. today. Look, let's understand. We've heard it today. The notion of clusters is based on a long history of academic scholarship that is rigorous and strong. It's been implemented at the state level by Democratic and Republican governors alike. There's nothing partisan about this. Its funding requirements are very modest by federal standards, $100 million. Some Michael Porter said to us during the transition, maybe it could be $200 million, $250. But by federal standards, it's not a huge amount of money. And it provides a basis to think about federalism for the 21st century. It's not just a question of top-down or bottom-up. It's the federal government having a defined role that's complementary to regional efforts. How? The federal government can frame national challenges. The federal government can facilitate information exchange and learning. And it can fund, in a helpful but not exclusive fashion, the cluster efforts. So we think it's a great idea. These are some answers we've offered. Comments in kibitzing, please. As I've said to you, what I've given you is an oral draft of the paper that Ed and I and Cap will, and Justin will put out in a week or so. Here are our email addresses. We're around today. So we would very much appreciate any responses, corrections, and improvements anyone would share with us. Thank you very much.
Haldar, yes.
Thank you. It is indeed a pleasure, and I want to thank Chuck for inviting me here to present to you and talk to you about the successes we've had in upstate New York, and also, you know, the causes for the success in terms of how it has actually come about in such a short period of time. Let me quickly go now. I've been told, Jonathan said he was a lawyer and he can talk for hours. I want to remind him I'm a professor. I can talk for more hours than he can, I'm sure. But I have been reminded to keep this short. So I'm going to try to skip through. I have a bunch of slides like a typical professor has. So I'm going to try and skip through some of them. And, you know, later on, if there's questions and issues, you can come and talk to me about some of them. The first slide I want to show you is, as you drive into New York, you almost always see a sign that looks pretty much like this. This is just to remind me to inform you that if we looked back into the 90s, especially if you were driving up into upstate New York, the economy was pretty much in shambles. There was a lot of job loss. There was a lot of industry shutting down. Especially manufacturing jobs were leaving the state and going elsewhere. Right about that, and this is across the entire upstate New York. I mean, from Buffalo all the way to Albany, New York. Albany at that time was a sleepy government town, very small, 100,000 in terms of population. If you include surrounding areas, it's about 800,000 or 700,000 or 800,000 people, including Schenectady and Troy. And you know, other than government, one of the major employers was GE. GE Energy had a major gas turbine manufacturing operation that at one time employed as much as 50,000 people. And in the 90s, they were employing somewhere close to 4,000 or 5,000 people. So that shows you the decline. And around the same time, you go to Rochester, Kodak and Xerox were suffering. You go out to Buffalo. Most of the steel industry was essentially shutting down. So with that, at that time, we had our then governor who had the vision. And this is one of the key components of actually trying to come up with a plan. How do you get about getting together the entire group to focus on a mission and move the economy forward? So at that time, this is one example. Nanotechnology, by the way, is just one example. There were about 5 or 6 different centers of excellence that were created by the governor with substantial amount of funding in terms of infrastructure projects, in terms of attracting companies, growing companies, and essentially economic development. And he centered most of them around universities at that time. The idea around nanotechnology, and nanotechnology is really the key success story here, and I'll tell you exactly. The story here is to explain to you, give you some historical context of how it came about and what actually happened. So if you look at the focus on R&D, education, and business strategy to not only attract and retain the nanotechnology industry of the future, that was the governor's key mission there. Right after some of the initial announcements that were made and some of the implementation plans that started to be put in place, New York jumped. Small Times magazine is actually one of the leading proponents of nanotechnology, of course, and we were not even on the list, and it jumped eventually to fourth spot in the whole thing there. This is where it stands today. 5 years ago, about 6 or 7 years ago, if you visited Albany, New York, this facility, there was nothing here. It was pretty much all green space. There was just one building. This is right outside on the northwest side of the University at Albany campus. This one building existed, and that was also built around that time period itself, 98, 99. And today, we have a cluster of about 5 or 6 different major buildings, a total of roughly about 1 million square feet. And you know, when we show this to people say, you know, how could you ever in 5, 6 years build so many buildings, that too in a university, and in a state university at that. So that's been a major accomplishment. We have key partners, of course, industry partners. And one of the key mantras, if you will, that we brought together here was the industry, university, and government partnership. And I'll talk a little bit about that too. But the partners, if you look at them, I mean, this is large partners that we started bringing together to begin with, Sematech, IBM, AMD, et cetera. I'll talk a little bit about that, too, in a second. Overall, in the last 6 years, we have achieved a total investment of roughly about $4.5 billion, and that was seeded, if you count all the state and federal money that went into this entire place, that was roughly about $700 or $800 million. So you look at almost a 1-to-6 multiplier effect in terms of the overall investment. And this is hardcore money that you can actually count, the investments that have been made, not including the overall multiplier effects that other people usually add from an economic development perspective. When I joined the place back in 2001, it was just a dream. There were about 40 people at the site over here, and we said we're going to create one of the world's greatest nanotech centers, if you will. And not a typical research nanotech center that you see in an academic institution. And again, I'll point out some of the key differences between what you'll see here and what you'll see in a typical university setting. Today, this number is already old, and it keeps growing. Today, we have about 2,500 people on the campus. By the end of this calendar year, it's expected to go to about 2,900. In fact, Semitech, who some of you may know, I think the DOC was responsible in a large way putting together Semitech back in 88, I believe. Semitech is moving its entire operation to Albany. That's about 400 or 500 people to be around the cluster that we have created, and that's going to happen by the end of this calendar year. There's been some other things that have happened too, and I'll explain to you how that all came about. A timeline, a historical perspective. If you look back, I mean, you know, we were a small research center funded by, at that time it was called the Science and Technology Office in New York State. That first building was built roughly about 1997. What we did was we attracted a key partner. I mean, IBM became one of what we call our anchor tenants. And the way we describe what we're doing here from a clustering standpoint is building basically a nano mall, if you will. So if you think about, you need the anchor tenant. You know, you have to attract the Macy's or the JCPenney's as the big anchor storefront, and then all the other smaller stores come around it. So that's part of what we actually did. We got a couple of major players that included IBM, Semitech, Tokyo Electron, ASML, and I'm not going to go into too much detail here because of the time limitations, of course. The college we created actually in 2004 after the fact, because we realized at some point that, you know, there has to be an education component from a workforce development standpoint, and I'll talk briefly about that too. So we essentially started from scratch. University at Albany, by the way, at SUNY, is not known for an engineering program. They don't have they still don't have an engineering program, actually. So a lot of this evolved from the sciences. It's primarily a liberal arts school. But we were able to, because we did this from scratch, we were able to design and build our own engineering program, if you will, that consisted of actually four different disciplines. And we heard earlier that we need to get the different disciplines, the scientists, the business folks, the engineers, the policymakers, to start talking together. So we created these kind of what we call constellations, so that we can get this cross communication to actually take place between a lot of these people. So we tried to break down a lot of the silos between these folks. We're going to be today. So in the matter of 3 or 4 years, the education side has grown quite a bit too. We almost have 50 faculty members, 150. Grad students, and we're starting an undergraduate program also fairly quickly. I would say in 2010 we will have an undergraduate program in nanoscience and nanoengineering. Again, this is the first college, a complete college in itself, that's offering degrees in these areas. And again, we're thinking completely outside the box, not looking at any of the traditional models that exist over there. Continuing on the timeline, if you look at 2005 to now, we're started to attract some other major players too, and consortiums. So we're looking at the entire value chain of the nanotech industry, not just the key semiconductor manufacturer or, you know, an end user, but who's supplying the materials, the gases, the construction folks. Everybody is involved in the planning and the discussion of what we do. One of the key successes we have, well, two of them actually, in 2006. And I'll talk about the second one later in a second, but Vistec was a company from Cambridge, England, 120 people. They completely moved their entire operation. They shut down their operation in Cambridge, England. They were proud of being very close to the University of Cambridge because of the key technology capabilities that they had there. 2006, they announced they're going to move completely and locate to our facility, and close by they're going to set up manufacturing operations for things like e-beam lithography and things like that. More recently, we did start to... We've started to now have close partnerships with organizations like NIST and the Army in terms of the technology that we're looking at providing. And also, there's a recent announcement of about $1.5 billion for a new packaging center in partnership with IBM and a bunch of other people too. So why does this work? Our model, as I indicated to you before, is different from a traditional university setting. And since we were able to build the college from the grassroots up and hire people from the outside, we balanced it in a way that 70 to 80% of the people that we hired, including faculty members, came from industry, so they could understand the key paradigm of what industry really needs. You know, if you look at a typical academic, and I mean, there's nothing against them. I don't have anything against them, but we do have academics in our place too that do a lot of very good fundamental basic research. But you know, looking into the future, universities are being forced to try and deliver to companies in exchange for the funding that they receive from them or the projects that they actually do for them. The traditional model is, you know, you do research, you throw it over the fence, the tech transfer guys throw it over the fence, they try to license it. And I think it was mentioned earlier that you know, tech transfer offices basically don't make any money at all. I mean, there's probably one or two organizations or maybe a handful of them that make any significant amount of money. So that's a barrier that we've broken down. We partner with our industry partners, and we figure out a way to break down those IP barriers. I mean, we're not looking at trying to make money out of the IP that we develop from them. In fact, you know, our biggest bang for the buck is the research money that the companies give to us. So that's one of the key critical components of how we've made it actually work. So just to summarize for a quick second, going back about 10 years ago when the governor said we want to create this really, state-of-the-art facility, what we did was we picked nanotechnology as the discipline, because going forward, we believe that is definitely the core of the future, created the infrastructure, the public-private partnerships, and created that educational component, which really followed what industry was looking at doing. So what we did was we put together this entire cluster, not just from the region itself, from the entire state. We looked at the resources that we had all the way from Buffalo to Long Island, and we added it up. You look at it, there's over 800 companies, and it's the entire supply chain, of course, we're talking about. As I said, the materials suppliers, the equipment manufacturers, et cetera, et cetera. We brought them together, and we tried to put, I mean, these are high-tech, high-paying jobs, as you can see as well, and we identified that there was a whole lot more. So we actually put this whole all together under one umbrella and said, you know, as Jonathan indicated, a one-stop shop. So we became the one-stop shop, not just for the technology, but also for making the business connections, helping them from a financing standpoint, helping them sharing the facilities, the technology, the IP, and leading them to manufacturing down the road. I want to talk a little bit about this. This is the biggest success story that we've had beyond just creating the 2,500 jobs in our region. Some of you may or may not know about this, but AMD has, this was announced actually back in 2006, but more recently they have raised additional financing and they've restructured themselves to call themselves Global Foundries. But this is the first greenfield manufacturing site in the U.S. that is being built in 20 years, primarily because of a lot of the inertia that has gone behind the nanotechnology initiatives that we have pushed. They're looking at manufacturing next generation technology, computer chips, semiconductor technologies, doing the packaging, and this is going to be 20 minutes away from where we are located. And they look at us as being the providers, not just of the technology, but for the workforce, as well as a lot of the business connections that they're going to have going forward. So again, in summary, two key drivers, the Centers of Excellence model going back to when the governor initiated that and creating the college, because the workforce was also a key component of what we were doing. I mean, now remember, we created a lot of this from scratch. And so if you look back 10 years ago and said, you know, nanotechnology and semiconductor manufacturing in Albany, New York, does that make sense? It didn't make sense to me. I would say some people are crazy that they're thinking about this stuff. But looking back, we have essentially changed the entire paradigm in creating the type of infrastructure that we've created. I'll add one more thing here from an economic standpoint. Albany, New York, the region around Albany, New York, is one of the few regions in the entire Northeast that I know of where housing prices have not dropped during this recession. There's still, the number of houses sold have gone down significantly, but the prices haven't gone down. And there's still a substantial amount of demand for housing, for example, in the capital region area, because of all the growth that's actually happening. So I'm going to skip this. This is just the vision, what we're trying to do. We have a certain operating model in terms of how we work with companies, and I think we're looking at our top level here, so I'm not going to talk about that. But just quickly, in summary, we're looking at actually, we're bridging the gap between where the universities come in to where companies tend to make money. So it's everything from the incubation. We heard about incubation. We do pilot prototyping. We do test bed integration. We do the entire gamut of what's of interest to these companies. Workforce development, this is a key component of what we do. So everything from the master's and PhD degrees, we partner with all these the community colleges. We also partner with K-12 institutions. We do high school internships. So we're looking at actually changing the entire workforce in the capital region to meet the needs for the future for the region. So one last in summary here, one thing I want to point out is, I mean, we've talked a lot about regional clusters and things like that. I think one of the key components of what we had going into this whole thing is we wanted to be a global force. And this was the visionary leadership of the governor at that time, which is the government, our university leaders, as well as industry, that saw the vision of putting this together and putting together a real key global type initiative. So we had companies from all over now, including Asia, come and move and set up shop in our facility. We have some competition. IMEC in Belgium is trying to duplicate what we're doing, and in Asia, Salit is also trying to do something similar. But this is the vision of what we're trying to do. So in summary, it's creating the business, the industry, and the university, and bringing them all together under one umbrella. And just one last thing I want to talk about is, you know, the fact that the nanotechnology industry is not only about semiconductors. We have a huge investment in the semiconductor infrastructure, but we're actually looking at applying it into a variety of different capabilities, including energy. And right now, we are again in partnership with New York State in creating and leveraging jobs and creating clusters around New York for green technology jobs. And what I mean by that is, you know, we have one of the most aggressive programs in New York State for energy. However, 80% of our $60 billion that we spent in New York on energy comes from outside the state. It's imported stuff. So we're looking at trying to use the resources to apply it in the state. And what's going to eventually happen is starting to create these centers of excellence type model that we talked about that was done 10 years ago. We're looking at creating and looking at the capabilities that we have going forward. Thank you. I'm sorry I went a little bit over time here.
Much. Have Mark Stanley.
I'm honored to be in this august group and also with a lot of my colleagues that are in the room. Let me just quickly say that I don't think there's been a better time to talk about innovation than with this new administration. There are a lot of people in this room, people from OSTP, who have a deep-seated interest in seeing that this president be successful, and I think this is an appropriate time because we have lots of concerns about our country, and finding new ways to innovate our government and open up transparency and employ various programs that exist without the need to necessarily create new ones. I completely agree with Jonathan. Just find ways to remanufacture what we're doing that gets to the states and help them become better test beds of economic development. I think there's huge challenges, but I've been in this game for a long, long time, and I have never seen such enthusiasm, which began with transition people coming to see us at NIST and following up today. And there are a lot of us who have met just recently last night trying to figure out ways in which we can get ourselves engaged with the government as well as with industry as well as with academia. So I'm excited to be here. I thank Chuck for the opportunity to participate in this process. I'm a big statesman. Dan Berglund's in the room from SSTI, and I've had the pleasure of working with him for a long time. This is an incredible quote. In essence, I think it maps what we're trying to talk about, and that is, it came from Justice Louis Brandeis, who said, "There must be power in the states and the nation to remold through experimentation our economic practices and institutions to meet changing social and economic needs. It's one of the happy incidents of the federal system that a single courageous state may, if its citizens choose, serve as a laboratory and try novel social and economic experiments." Issued a long time ago, I take that as a challenge for all of us, and as I've opened my remarks, I think the opportunity to do this now is better than it's ever been before. So why TIP? I'm not here to preach to you about one aspect of this program. Roger Kilmer's here from MEP. Harry Hertz runs Quality Program. Lots of different types of shops in the department that the current secretary is very high on utilizing in ways to improve innovation with business. But at least from my perspective, both for my fellow program MEP and myself, is we do have federal dollars. We do want to retain and develop new high-tech industries. We do want to maintain and increase jobs, and we want to help them increase their revenues. And so all of us have a responsibility here of looking how our programs can work much better with states, looking for new ways to do either regional partnership initiatives or improve or identify ways in which we can do clusters. And I think that's an imperative that we have to focus much more on. I sort of looked at the national imperatives that are coming down from this administration because I didn't want to necessarily just make a token statement, not back it up with fact. So these are some of the things that the Obama administration is talking about. We've heard about them a lot. I can tell you they are working very diligently, very hard to kind of figure out how they want to focus this effort and become much more a transparent and connected democracy. I think it's essential. I think it's going to work. I think we all have responsibilities to help it work. In rejuvenating American innovation, I sort of looked at several aspects of the challenges that exist here. Talent, obviously you've heard a little bit about that this morning. This work that's being done in New York State is just unbelievable. And you know, NIST is happy to share one part in that and working with stuff beyond CMOS. Investment sources are a problem today. Obviously, the venture capital community is not as eager for lots of reasons to get down to the earliest stage of investment. Yes, there's a role for the government, but not only the government. Yes, there's a role for leadership from the states and from industry and from academe. And, of course, the infrastructure issue is huge, is absolutely huge. And whether we use incubators or whether we use university research parks, or whether we improve the model that Jonathan talked about with EDA, I think these are some of the components that we have to focus on. The public-private partnership era is something I've spent a lot of time, as I said earlier. So local, state, federal. I see Heinz Foundation is going to be talking this afternoon as well. The use of private endowments and foundation consortia, philanthropists. And then it's not just venture capitalists. I was at a meeting last night, and there was some discussion about where angels are playing, but they don't want to mess with the federal government. They have their own ideas of how they want to get engaged, and, of course, investors. And finally, these strategies that led to this discussion this morning, thanks to Dr. Westner and others, is how do we kind of look at the various tools and create this opportunity to innovate? Using talent, using resources, and this exercise of social entrepreneurship. The policy and culture that consistently rewards invention, innovation, and competitiveness. Again, I don't want to sound like the old Billy Graham of innovation here, but I have been around this a long, long time. We all talk about it. We have periods of time when everybody gets exercised about it, and then it stops. This is a change agent. It's going to take a lot of hard work, and we cannot drop the ball. Very simply, and I'm preaching to the choir, every other country is doing the same darn thing. I just had the honor this morning to address 40 countries at the French embassy who want to know about the TIP program. And I'm not sort of stupid enough to believe they just wanted to hear about the TIP program. They're trying to find ways to innovate. And if they take the TIP program and let them do it, they're going to do it. Don't have to preach. This is a different chart on the Valley of Death. You know, how do we employ these programs between basic science, the new eARPA program, the SPEAR program, the TIP program, the MEP program, the economic recovery investments? Because that crossover from the roles that we play at the agencies, universities, and states, we still have this problem of the end result. How do we help them commercialize? So that's not only the role of the federal government, but I think we need to look at the whole system and then figure out where the various pieces are where we can assist. Rich Bennis, you'll hear about later, has his own views about creating a new innovation fund of funds. I'm in favor of anything that makes us more competitive. So here comes TIP. Change the whole policy debate. I have been referred to by some of my best friends as Lazarus because of all the times I've risen. I'm not sure I really accept that as a compliment or not, but in any event, this program has changed the whole paradigm. It is not ATP. Its focus is much more directed to early stage basic research and investment in applied research. Only small, medium-sized companies can participate. Huge driver in universities now. And in fact, last year, the majority of our joint ventures were led by universities. That's a huge shift. And, of course, we'll still be involved in high-risk, high-reward research, but no longer will we have general competitions. We will be investing in critical national needs, and I'll define that for you very shortly. Part of NIST, I love NIST. I'm delighted that it was called out with NSF and DOE and the Competes Act. I'm delighted that the administration sees its value. And I know with the leadership at NIST and the secretary, there's a huge effort to have us engaged in smart grid, in cybersecurity, and in technology building. So we draw upon that expertise in terms of reviews for the proposals that are coming our way. And I think there's a synergistic relationship between our program and the scientists to sort of lead the future about where measurement standards may have to come. So why do I think we're different now? Because our raison d'etre is that we're going to have to do a gap analysis that determines why government should invest. Not that it should always do that. And as you see by this definition, our attention is going to be on the magnitude of the problem because it's so large and its challenges are so significant that if we don't, that would lead to economic ruin. But we have to also look at the societal challenges, the problem or the issues, and if those are not addressed through high-risk, high-reward investments, that also could be a problem. These are sort of the key features. I like the word transformational. I view that word as I'm interested in investing in disruptive technologies. I'm not interested in pulling down the easy ones. I want to shoot for the hardest ones that address important areas where we are hurting right now. And if, in fact, we're not duplicating what's going on in the federal government, I think in some part TIP and NIST are part of that innovation ladder. And we're not the only game in town, but I think we can be essential in helping. I've already talked about the participants. Large companies, by the way, can participate. They just can't get a federal share. And we define currently large companies as any company that's in excess of $1.63 billion in total revenues. That will review that every year based on the Fortune magazine's categorization of the top 1,000. Structure changes a little bit in terms of funding. The Congress wanted more funding to single companies, up to $3 million from two. They capped joint ventures to $9 million. Still retained the 3 years research for single companies, 5 years for joint ventures. They did add a rather sizable cost share of 50-50, and I heard some complaints about that. But interesting to note, last year we had more than a sufficient amount of proposals come in, and they weren't bothered by it. That's always subject for future review. We have done an extensive gap analysis. My compliments to Chuck. I put him through probably a tougher exercise than even producing this conference by hosting both a private and a public forum so I could get a sense of what was out there not being studied. I employed the Science and Technology Policy Institute that advises the OSTP to get a sense of what was going on in the federal agencies. And I spent a lot of time traveling around the various universities to determine what other things of importance of the nation's critical national needs weren't being addressed by the government and TIP should consider them. And then I've called for white papers, and ultimately it will be a convener of regional and national meetings to kind of get that analysis. So in the initial work that we did last year, we identified these seven areas. They're multidisciplinary. Two I've already funded, last year in civil infrastructure, this year in manufacturing and civil infrastructure. They're not meant to be exhaustive. They map onto administration policies. They map onto university research. And they map on to work that's being done at the state of New York and other states at this time. I should tell you that in areas like manufacturing, where I think we have some serious issues of future investment, I'm not ready to cede the United States to the rest of the world. So I think NIST is working very hard to come up with new ways in which we can compete. So what do I need from you? Obviously, this is a forum for me to not only talk about one aspect of what the government's doing, but also a chance to poll from you independently your views, as Jonathan said, non-proprietary white papers about what I should be focusing on, because that makes the program much more targeted. And I think I'll end with this quote. I love to be the keeper of quotes. So this came from the National Academy of Engineering in one of the reports in 2008, and it states, "The century ahead poses challenges as formidable as any from millennia past. As the population grows and its needs and desires expand, the problem of sustaining civilization's continuing advancement while still improving the quality of life looms more immediate. So I, for one, and NIST and the department are willing to pick up this challenge, and we look forward to more discussion this afternoon. Thank you very much.
Chuck, do we have time for a couple questions, or are you trying to get us back on track? Well, I'll invite folks if they have questions. Go ahead.
Bob Samors from the Association of Public and Land-Grant Universities, particularly to the New York experience. What was the role of the university leadership in the initiative?
I think the university was the key driver in putting this whole thing together. And very quickly we realized that the university itself was the was playing such a central role to trying to put all of the key players together. So it was necessary for us to bring together, for the private partners. For example, if we were not playing that intermediary role of bringing everybody together, if it was one specific industry member, then their competition wouldn't want to be part of that entire process. So being a neutral, Switzerland-type entity, we played a major role in getting all people together. So it was not just getting the industry together, it was convincing the government that we did some substantial amount of investment in infrastructure programs to make this happen. So it had to come from the university. It wouldn't have happened any other.
Well, I'm going to take a chance to ask a question since I have a microphone. And my question is, and I think it's going back to your last slide, Jonathan, which is, as we move forward, how we build support for these things. If Mark's the Billy Graham of innovation, I guess that makes me the Tammy Faye Baker because I've cried so many tears. We've been through the battles where we have been criticized for trying to do industrial policy and trying to do a top-down federal policy. And while this has the advantage of sort of the federalism that you talked about and the regional approach, I wonder how we talk about that to people outside of this room and people who hadn't been following the academic literature and all of that for the past 10 years. And, you may not be the only person on the panel has a question, has a thought on that, but.
The song on this one is Try a Little Tin. Look, Congress is deciding right now whether to fund EDA reauthorization bills are going to both houses of Congress. Very important that people from Congress hear about the advantages of these policies from people at the state and regional level. Hearing from people in the Beltway does almost no good. But look, when I was up talking to someone in Senate Appropriations during the transition, what did they talk about? They talked about the fact that every time a manufacturing extension program comes up, they get letters from every other member of the U.S. Senate. Because it's state-based, governors care about it, senators respond. What the paradigm here, which I refer to maybe as 21st century federalism, is that states lead and the federal government facilitates. To have that get through Congress, people who, like yourselves, who are knowledgeable, who have expertise, who understand the importance of this, need to have your voices heard, not only with ourselves, but frankly, where it's going to be decided over the couple of months. I think that's fundamental.
I have both a question and to follow up on your remark, Mark Gene. The Academy is not closely linked to creationism as a key explanation for how we get here, and we also are not very tolerant of flat Earth theories. we equally think that the idea that let me get this right. We don't pick winners and losers, except maybe for GM or Boeing or McDonnell Douglas, if you want the losers, or the agricultural sector, or the few guys who run the farms that produce sugar down in Louisiana. So we keep those Caribbeans at bay. I don't have time, but every industry in this country that exports has had major support from the federal government. And my point is, in this administration, this new elan, I think we need to go past arguments that are factually, historically, and conceptually wrong. Not that I feel strongly about this, but I
wasn't taking that position myself, as you know.
No, as you know. But we do let ourselves get into the game. I mean, the quick answer to winners and losers is we want to pick the winners. The losers will take care of themselves. I mean, but every as you heard Mark say, everyone else in the world is working hard on this. And this is as Apple is as American as apple pie. The Radio Corporation of America was called that because of the equity stake by the Navy, the patent pulling force by the Department of Justice with Marconi and Westinghouse and General Electric. You know, the Aluminum Corporation of America, why? Well, we actually built the industry and then sold it off for a dollar after the war. I mean, we're not taught that in school. So it's very important to drive a deep stake through that. Now, my question, and I did have one, but that's probably one of the most important things, just to push back in their face really hard when people start talking nonsense about important things. The money, did you have any significant funding credit from the federal government directly or indirectly for the effort, the remarkable efforts that you've launched there?
No. Initially, over the last the first 5 or 6 years, the entire effort was essentially the collaboration. When we talk about government in this scenario, it's the state government. And fortunately, in the first half of this decade, New York State was flush with cash and was able to make a lot of investments. More recently, we have started receiving a substantial amount of federal grants. But I totally agree with you. I mean, you know, if you go back again, look at from a historical perspective, University of Albany, and I said this, was a liberal arts university. Who would, in their right minds, competitively grant the University of Albany $100 million to build a, you know, the kind of infrastructure and the programs that we currently have? So it went beyond that. And in that scenario, yes, winners and losers were chosen by those folks. But just wanted to add that to it.
Can I just say something? I think I have a little bit of a different point of view, and it's not disagreeing, but it's maybe another. Gene's exactly right. The moment is going to come where everything that's being talked about is going to be acted as in policy. We saw it in the 90s. We're going to see it again. Your historical analysis is fundamental, but I think there's another point that ought to be laid aside. It. What we are talking about here is not the government selecting which firms will succeed. What we're talking about is creating really what is the counterpart of the U.S. Postal Service or public education or land grant public goods that create shared advantages to the benefits of communities that assist businesses and workers alike with metrics of economic growth and positive social outcomes. That does not look like anybody's depiction of industrial policy, and I think it's a formulation that will be important for us to use.
We've got one in the back, and we may not have time for you, Jim, and I'll apologize if that happens.
This question is Steve Crawford, Brookings. This question is directed to Jonathan, and your particular bullet about what organizations would be eligible to apply for the cluster grants, and in particular, I think you said that regions or clusters would be self-designated, the regional coverage. And that makes a lot of sense in a lot of ways, but I want to suggest weighing that against an alternative, which is that we are struggling in this country to recognize that economies and innovation are regional. Council on Competitiveness and other groups have been emphasizing it for a decade. We know in many respects it's true, but it's so hard to make it operational because within any given effective metropolitan region, you have dozens and dozens of competing counties, townships, cities, et cetera. So the question is, wouldn't it be helpful if EDA could reorganize its concept of region around the existing metropolitan regions that are out there and help those and incentivize those to have some regional capacity to coordinate infrastructure investments and workforce and innovation investments? And to that extent, and the Wired Initiative really came up with some pretty wacky geographies when you look at the grants that were funded. And so I don't know whether you could offer extra points for a region that was, you know, coterminous with a metropolitan region, not a political region, but a Bureau of Labor Statistics defined, or Census Bureau defined, region, metropolitan region. I just want to put that on the table because there's a real tension there in terms of our long-term economic growth.
Let me say how we were thinking about it, which may not be right because your points are important. Our thought was that for the grants that go to the effectuation of cluster strategy, we want to incentivize regional cooperation. And therefore, having the grants go to the economic unit, not the political unit, would help incentivize the kind of regional cooperation that would be used, but that the smaller planning grants could be used by those political entities that have yet to achieve that kind of regional understanding or networking. Having said that, I take your point as very important. It's a dynamic work.
Well, I want to thank Dr. Wessner for having all of us on behalf of these distinguished gentlemen, and thank you all for wonderful presentations.